Hello and welcome to Launch. We're broadcasting live from Atlanta, Georgia. I'm Ron Reardon. My co-host is Bill McHenry. Bill, how are you today?
Absolutely super, Ron. How are you today?
I'm doing fine, doing better and better. They say if I was any better, I'd have to be twins.
We don't want that.
That's right. No, one of me is enough. Well, Bill, on Launch, we focus on the launching of a business so that entrepreneurs can successfully navigate their launch. This morning, we're featuring Peggy Brown of Peggy Brown Creative Consulting. But before we get started, Bill, could you thank today's sponsor?
I sure will, Ron. Today, our sponsor is Patents & More. Patents & More, protecting your innovation and connecting you to the resources you need for success.
And we really appreciate their support. Well, Peggy Brown has worked for many of the world's biggest game and toy companies as an inventor, a designer, a writer, creative director, consultant, and executive. She started and ran a successful design and development company called Alley Hoop, which provided creative services to Hasbro, Mattel, Fisher-Price, Tyco, Playmates, and other companies. And having development work on hundreds of products, including licenses to Barbie and Warner Brothers, Disney, Sesame Street, McDonald's, and Nickelodeon, Peggy now runs a consulting and development firm that works with toy companies and publishers globally. She's the inventor of dozens of games and author of numerous creative activity books with Random House and LaCord Andrews McNeil Publishers. And her website is www.peggybrown.net. Welcome to the show, Peggy.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Well, Peggy, how did you decide on a career path of basically working for Santa Claus?
It was a little bit of kismet, I have to admit. I studied industrial design when I was in college. And it just so happened that I interviewed a couple of different places after I graduated. One was designing steering wheels for tractors. One was designing toasters and pots and pans. And then the third place that I interviewed was a game and toy company. So that's the job that I ended up taking, and that's kind of how I got into the business.
Okay. It's always a kind of a slender thread how that happens.
Yeah, I think so. I think in a way, though, it was meant to be. I'm much more suited to this kind of work than I'm sure I would have been at tractors.
Peggy, what did you study to prepare for this new gig, if you will?
Well, I have a fine arts degree. My major was industrial design, which is essentially product design. And in the course of that study, you learn all about everything from building products and materials and methods, but you also learn about human factors and the way that people interface with products. And when I think about the people that were in my class in school, some of them went to Detroit to design cars, and some of them, I think one of them went to head up the Rose Parade in Pasadena, doing all the floats and everything, being in charge of that. There's another one that went to Mercury Marine, which is a company that makes all kinds of boats and outboard motors. And then I'm not sure where everybody landed, but that training can really take you in lots of different directions, but it's all about problem solving and developing products, designing things for people to use and enjoy.
Huh.
That's pretty neat. Well, Peggy, I used to do a lot of whitewater kayaking. And we had a lot of discussion at one time about what's the best exercise in order to be, really good at whitewater kayaking. And we decided that the best exercise was actually to do a lot of whitewater kayaking. Nothing particular in the gym.
Yeah.
So I'm sure it's that way in the work that you do, that the more you work in that area, the better your intellectual muscles get.
That's absolutely true. And, you can only get so much in school. School gives you this really good set of skills. It gives you the sort of the methods that you can continue to go back to and draw from on how to think things through and how to build things and how to go about the process. But you're right about that. You really have to do a lot of it. You have to, the more you do, the better you get at it. I remember hearing a story once about, it was a ceramics teacher. And he did an experiment one semester. He divided the class into two halves. And the first half, he said, now, this semester you make something and you make it as perfect as you can, and you take your time and you plan and you figure it out and you take the whole semester to make this one thing perfect. And then to the other half of the class, he said, I want you to make as many things as you can. And you don't worry about making it perfect. You just work on as many things as you can. And at the end of the year, everybody put their stuff on the table, and there was all kinds of things. And all of the best pieces came from the side that did the most pieces. I think you're right about flexing the creative muscles. You have to do a lot of it in order to really begin to understand how to do it. And if you nitpick and you get mired in the details and you worry about, you know, it's not quite finished, you never really do get to the point where you can really, really sail on doing lots of things and lots of things well.
Yeah, I agree completely.
That actually kind of surprised me. I thought you were going to tell me just the opposite.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know why. I just did because I always kind of think about focusing.
And, well, you know, I don't know if it's so much about focusing, but I think it's about trying and not being afraid to fail when you try. And when you're charged with making something perfect, that's a little bit daunting. But when you have no parameters about the degree of success that you're setting out to accomplish, I think you're not focused on that. You're focused on what you're actually doing.
Yeah, trying to be perfect can be a tremendous trap. I used to be in IT, and I had people reporting to me, and we were supposed to have this one particular computer program out, and I'd go to the coder, and he says, "Well, we're not finished yet," and I'd come back the next month, and he says, "Well, there's a few more things I want to make sure that if they happen that we're okay, and it doesn't shut the system down." And I go back the next month, and same story. And finally, I said, "Look, this program goes out this week, okay? I know that you've not thought of every possible situation that could possibly shut down the program, but it's good enough. Get it out."
Right. Yeah, I think there always comes a point where you have to be able to just kind of stop. And I think the other thing that happens, especially in my business, is that you have to remember that Christmas is always coming, and you really don't get the luxury to go past your deadlines or take extra time in order to kind of fine-tune things. There are real dates that need to be met with everything, and so you kind of have to wiggle within the parameters of the calendar.
Right. And there's something about the creative juices that, you know, if you're creative in one area and creative in another area, then, you know, sometimes you'll get cross links of, well, you know, we could use this creative idea over here in this area.
Oh, that happens all the time. And I think when you think too much within one channel, you're really shortchanging yourself, because I think some of the most innovative items come from cross-pollination. You know, you learn about some gizmo and, you know, you go to the hardware store and you find something, and then you think, wow, I could make something in a toy framework that uses this sort of a mechanism, and then you've got something fresh and new. But if you really try to think only in the one area that you're working in general, I think you really sort of put the kibosh on a lot of things that could be happening that are sort of magical, just because you're not looking outside of where you live.
Right. I don't know if you're familiar with the origin of Pringles potato chips, but a mechanical engineer was working where they're punching out. He was actually working in a soap company, and he, you know, would get his regular bag of potato chips, and it'd all be crumbled in different sizes, and kind of disgusted him. And so he looked at the machine that was punching out basically something like Dial soap with a nice little curve to it. And he says, "What if instead of putting soap slurry in here, we put a potato slurry and we change the mold so that instead of being thick like a bar of soap, it was nice and thin like a chip that we could stack into a can?" And that's how Pringles potato chips came to be.
Yeah, you know, that's the other part of it, too, is it's not only to innovate towards something you're trying to make, but it's also to be able to recognize when there's something that's a possibility that you hadn't considered. And oftentimes, you're trying to make something specific, and it fails, and you end up with something else. And it's really part of the trick is to be able to realize that that something else is something else that could be wonderful in some kind of a different application. The gentleman that invented the Slinky was, I think he was sort of a marine engineer. He worked on mechanics for marine, I don't even know what it was. But he had a spring on his workbench which fell off, and it sort of walked, you know, it sort of did that Slinky thing. And, you know, a lot of people would just pick it up and put it on the desk and keep working on whatever they were working on. But he recognized that there was some kind of a sparkle in that, and that it was interesting enough to pursue in a different area, completely separate area from where he was focused. And that's a really important thing to learn how to do.
Yep, I agree. We'll go back to your beginnings of when you got started and everything, and share with our listeners a little bit of how those first couple of projects you were working on went.
I'm trying to think back. The first job that I took out of school, I was a staff designer at a game company, and you know, I think the first job I was designing, they were like checkers for a game called King's Court, and I seem to remember that I wanted them to look like marble because it was sort of like a royal-looking themed game. And, you know, I always have to go past what's common, of course, and so I had to figure out a way to get the injection molding equipment not to mix colors well enough so that when the checkers were molded that they would have this marbled finish. We'd kind of put two colors of plastic in the hopper and not melt them all the way. And, of course, then we had to modify the manufacturing equipment to not do its job as well as it always would, because most people want a nice, even color when they mold things. And we kind of had to end up undoing that a little bit. But, you know, you learn a lot. All these processes, you learn a lot, and you can then apply that to other things. So, wow, that's a really long time ago. You're asking me to dig pretty deep. But but that was, you know, I haven't thought about that in a long, long time. And once again, it was one of those kind of projects where you try to push the envelope just a little bit, and you sort of dance within the little bitty, you know, guidelines that you have to work in, and see what good you can come out, what you can make come out of design a checker, you know, design the
wow.
little thing. So,
what was the most fun the product that you've I should rephrase that? What product did you develop, Peggy, that you enjoyed the most?
Oh, man, that's like choosing between your children. I don't know. I can't even think. I have no idea. You know, they're all so different. And sometimes you're just doing things quickly. Sometimes you're doing them and you're trying to make it come into for such a low price point. For instance, if you're doing something for a premium that maybe goes to Pizza Hut or someplace where you've got, you know, 30 cents to put together some kind of magical little thing. And then sometimes you're working with big companies where the information is interesting, where perhaps they would fly you out to a conference room and where you can read a movie script where they wouldn't let it out of their hands, and then you learn about a movie that's coming up that you can then develop product along with the storyline of the movie. I don't know. There's a lot of really yeah. rich experiences that go along with this job, because you're working in tandem with not only toy companies, but licensing companies, and you're working on things that are hot topically in the pop culture or in the vernacular of what's going on currently. I don't know, really, really interesting stuff.
Give our listeners a couple examples of a couple movies that you worked on and made some products around.
The first one I remember, and it turned out to be kind of a bomb of a movie. It was called, what was it called? It was an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, and it was right after he was doing those huge blockbusters. It was called Last Action Hero.
Okay.
And it was this thing where he was, I forget, they were jumping in through the movie screen, and he'd go in this other world, and he'd come back out. And we were charged with developing the game for that. And so we were privy to the storyline a few months before the movie was to come out, so that we could make product that paralleled the movie, and then of course it would be in the stores ready for merchandising when the movie came out, which is typical of what happens. I mean, it is pretty remarkable when you see a movie come out and then all of a sudden the stores are filled with the merchandise that goes along with it, but that's pretty well orchestrated. And so I remember that, and I didn't get to go into the meeting with Arnold Schwarzenegger, but I heard that he had a cigar and he never took his sunglasses off. Anyway, you hear all the stories. But, it, you know, it is, as a young designer, it's really exciting to think about that you're making decisions on a product, on a game or a toy or whatever. But it is kind of part of this bigger, you know, bigger thing that's happening. What else? Oh, I've worked on lots of Barbie stuff. Let's see, for media. Well, I worked on a number of the boy band games. I did the NSYNC Backstreet Pass, NSYNC Backstage Pass game. I did a Backstreet Boys game. And in those, in the NSYNC one, for example, we put the prototype together, and then we had to go find the bands, get the boys to sign off on the game. So we had to chase them down at one of their concerts and get into their, you know, underground, under the stadium, and follow around with their agents, and that was pretty remarkable. And all over just getting the approval for us to start the presses on the game. I don't know, just, you know, you have these sort of ancillary experiences that take you off the desk as a designer, you know, where you're usually working.
Sure.
And it kind of adds a lot of pretty rich experience to your work.
I know when I was in the corporate world, I worked for Zenith. I was in charge of their merchandising, and we did a promotion with the Thomas Crown Affair and also Pokemon.
Sure.
And I remember my boys, who are like 18 and 23 now, they thought, man, Dad, you get to work with Pokemon. That was like, wow.
Yeah, but, you know, it's good for kids to understand that all this stuff comes from someplace. It's not magic, you know. And still today, I meet people. And, you know, they ask, what do you do? And you tell them, and they think, wow, I never really thought about that, that had to come from somewhere. And it's remarkable to me still how people, they can go buy a car, they can go buy a TV, they can go buy anything, and they don't understand, somehow, they don't understand that had to be thought about by someone, that had to be, you know, that there are hundreds of people's livelihoods wrapped up in just making that one thing and bringing it to market.
Yeah.
And, I don't know if they think there's a, you know, like a tree where cars grow, or it baffles me that it strikes so many people that they never thought about where anything comes from.
Yeah, because you know
how long it takes to develop something too is amazing.
Yeah, well, that they have no idea, and they also have no idea that a product, you know, if it costs $5 to make, it sells for $30 in the store. You know, they don't really understand the formula of why things are the way they are, and.
Yeah,
because you know that cow's milk comes from a spigot, okay?
Yeah, I knew that.
I thought it came from a plastic jug.
No, it comes from a spigot into the plastic jug. Well, you know, Peggy, when I was young.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah, I know. Kids just don't connect the dots as to where things come from.
Oh, I'm not even talking about kids.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
I'm talking about a lot of people.
Yeah.
Well, I grew up being a real avid reader of the Sunday comics, and one of my favorite comics was about this caveman, and his name was Ali Oop. So I'm fascinated by your name for your company called Ali Oop. Tell us how you came up with the name and how you got put that together.
Well, I had a roommate in college who was a graphic designer, and I studied industrial design, and we had these bunk beds in we had a little tiny apartment, and we used to, you know, sit up at night and dream, and we always talked about opening up a studio, and we had, you know, our skills kind of complemented each other, and, you know, we just kind of went for it. We were only, I think, 23 when we started that company, and all we had was a set of markers, and we said, okay, now we're in business, and we kind of grew the company, but the name was funny. We thought, well, this was back before there was internet and before there was a lot of different ways to get your name out there. And we thought, well, if our name is going to be in the phone book, we want it to start with A. So we got a bottle of wine and we just started brainstorming A names. We wanted something that was fun and something that sounded helpful and something, I don't know, it just kind of happened, and that's what we decided to call it. It had nothing to do with the cartoon. As a matter of fact, that cartoon was so much, it so predated our time that we didn't even really know it was a cartoon until later on. But
I think that was a big run, that you're old.
That's right. But back when, back when dinosaurs roamed the earth, that's when I was reading these cartoons.
Yeah.
But, you know,
that's what the cartoon's about.
that's right. But, you know, alley-oop has another meaning, of course. You know, when you're helping somebody, give them a boost, you know, over a wall or something like it, say alley-oop.
Yep, or when you throw the basketball up and the other guy slams it into the bucket. But mostly we just wanted some funny-sounding name that people would remember. A lot of our contemporaries had gone into the advertising business, and a lot of the ad agencies are named for people's last names, and then they would part company and switch, and then it would be this name and that name, and then it would be that name and another name. And we always thought it was difficult for people to remember who was who and what was what and what they did, and so we figured we were going to be in the toy business. We wanted something fun. That's about it.
Okay.
How did you pick the toy business, Peggy?
Well, it was really just because when I first started working after I graduated college, I was at a toy company. And
okay.
It was less than 3 years I was there, a great big corporation called Western Publishing in the game division. Just in those couple of years I was there, I just kind of fell in love with it. And I learned that it was a really good place for me because it was the kind of thinking I like to do. It was designing not only stuff, not only products, but you're also designing fun, which is sort of an intangible thing, but, you know, you really have to think it through, and you get to orchestrate how people behave when they use the things that you create. And I liked that aspect, and I also liked the content in a lot of the games I was working on. There was plenty of opportunity to be witty and funny and do all kinds of story building, and to me, it seemed to be a real good match for the skills that I had, or really, moreover, for the things that I enjoyed doing. So when I think about some of the other career paths I could have taken, where I would be designing, you know, mechanical parts for machinery or consumer goods like pots and pans or like shoes or those kinds of things, I really think that it was really kind of perfect that I fell into this business because I get to marry a lot of the skills that I have. I mean, it's really sort of a rare occasion where you have somebody that's good at artwork who can also be a very good writer, who can also be a good sort of engineer. And I always like to dabble in a lot of those kinds of things, so that's kind of how it made sense for me.
Okay.
Well, tell us a little bit about the books.
Go ahead, Ron.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about the books that you've written.
I've written a number of books, and a couple of the last two that have been out are actually those. I know you go into the bookstore around the holidays and you see those tables full of those big fat page a day calendars where you tear off a page and something new happens every day. Well, I've done a couple of them where they're craft and activity calendars. They call them calendars, but it's really a book, or it's essentially a box full of almost like recipe cards where there's crafts and activities for kids and families. So the last couple of years, I've done this where you make up all these craft activities to go on these cards. And it's a pile of work, but it's really cool. There are a lot of art teachers in grammar schools and even friends and neighbors that say, oh, I love that. I can just go to it. I can pull a card and it'll give us something to do on a rainy day. And essentially those are just little projects that you can do with your kids to make things out of things that you have around the house, like toilet paper tubes and popsicle sticks and all that kind of thing. So the kind of books that I write are more activity-based. I have a new book coming out this fall with Random House. It's called The Golden Book of Family Fun. And it's kind of one of these big, fat compendiums of everything fun that you can think of doing. And in this case, it's not just crafts and little activities like that, but it's also, you know, games you can play in the car and things you can do with your grandpa and, you know, recipes that you can make for somebody's birthday or, ghost stories and all kinds of stuff. It's just this sort of big, giant how-to-have-fun book. I'm real excited about it, but I've got to wait now, four or five more months before it hits the store, so.
How long did it take you to develop that book, Peggy?
That book? Everybody asks me that. I don't really keep track of these kinds of things, but I think it probably took me a few months to write it. It was actually one of these situations where the publisher approached me and we worked on it together. But I wrote it in a few months, and then I think it's about 140-something pages, and there's a ton of illustration that needs to take place, and that takes quite a long time, too. So there's been almost another year in illustrations, and then, of course, there's production and shipping and everything. So I think I started on this book almost, well, not 3 years ago, but 2.5 years ago.
Oh, wow.
So in addition to the work that you do on something, there's everybody else who has their role in actually bringing it to fruition. So when you add all that time up, it can take a while.
Wow. How many people are involved with writing a book like that?
Well, I did the writing, and then I have an editor at the publishing company that kind of, we work together, you know, she would say the kinds of the kinds of things they were after, and then I would put together a big list. Here's what I think should go in it. And it really came from me, but then when I got the manuscript finished, she would go through, and, of course, they would test a lot of the activities, and it was kind of funny. I love these kinds of books, and I sort of got a little bit overzealous, and she called me up after I turned in the manuscript. She said, "Peggy, you have to cut 60%. Cut it out. It's never going to fit. We don't have enough pages." So I'm like, okay. I just couldn't stop. So I had to go back, and I had to sort of eviscerate the manuscript down to little less than half of what it had originally been. And I said, "Well, you know, you can look at this another way. If the first book succeeds, we've already got the second one in the can. So nothing is ever for waste. It's just you kind of have to go through this process and then cut back and pick the cherries out of what you started with."
Wow.
It is a little bit of a push and pull because she's got to fit it into the format that they've already decided on their price point and what their manufacturing cost should be and how they're going to, you know, all that stuff gets lined up, and then your creative work has to fit within that framework.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, I understand.
How long have you been working as an entrepreneur, Peggy?
Well, most of my career I've been an entrepreneur. I started at that big toy company, and then I started Alley-Oop, and then that was 8 years or so, and another couple of years. Then I went inside another toy company as a creative director and a vice president over the creative department. And this last, this company I've got now, I think it's about just over five years. And it's kind of an interesting perspective. I really understand what it's like inside a big corporation, inside a medium-sized company, having done a small company where when I had Alley-Oop, I think we had 7 or 8 people on staff. And then now I just kind of fly solo and I subcontract a lot of the things that where I need help. So it's kind of, I've done a little bit of everything. And what that's provided for me is this pretty interesting perspective on why things work the way they work, what's happening inside the companies when you're on the outside, vice versa. It's been a really good sort of aggregate of experience to put me where I am right now. And the way the business is now, and I have so many relationships built over the years from being in the business and inside and outside and all around this toy business that now I've got these relationships that I can draw on, and it's not that difficult to work by myself because I have a lot of my groundwork is already laid.
So when it comes to subcontracting, you're basically working with folks that you've worked with in the past.
Yeah, in a lot of cases. I mean, every once in a while you end up with some kind of quirky project where you need somebody who can make some kind of a widget that you don't know how to make or that you have to find somebody with a particular skill set. But, I collaborate with people that I've known for a long time. And my subcontractors are generally people that I know or that I've worked with in the past.
Okay. Well, when you were talking about having to cut stuff out for the most recent book, it brought me back to I created a book back in 2003 called The Creative Thoughts Journal. And my goal in that particular book was that it'd be something that would either fit in a woman's purse or in a man's shirt pocket. So I knew what the dimensions needed to be and how thick it could be. And so it's basically designed to be a miniature inventor's journal with grid work, and it also had inspirational quotes on each page. And so I grounded up all these inspirational quotes that really related to inventors and inventing and great entrepreneurs. And I had way too many that the book, there was no way in the world it would fit in a shirt pocket. And the most excruciating thing was to toss out all these really great quotes to end up with just the ones that would go into this book that would be the right thickness.
Right, but you never discard them completely. You've got those someplace, right?
Yes, I do. I still have them for book number 2.
See, yeah. And that's what happens over time is that you end up with this giant scrap heap of all good stuff.
That's right.
And you can always pull from it. And, you know, I can't tell you how many times I've had, you know, you create something that for whatever reason misses the mark of who you're trying to show it to or sell it to. And then you come back to the drawing board and you redress it. And you put some other kind of special sauce on it or whatever you do to it, and then all of a sudden the light bulb goes on and somebody else thinks it's spectacular.
That's right.
So nothing is ever for waste. And you know, my brother always says this, I think this is funny. He says, nothing is ever completely for waste because it can always be used as a bad example. So even if it's even if it doesn't turn out quite where you find it to be useful, at least it's useful for something.
Yeah, now that's a book I can write about bad examples and bad decisions, you know.
Yeah.
That reminds me of the joke of the young starting off at the very bottom executive was asked to take some papers to the top person in the corporation. And that person was supposed to be gone. They weren't supposed to be there. So they said, just go into his office. You know, he's not here. And just put it on his desk. And so he goes on up there, goes on in, and the executive was there. And he says, oh, excuse me, I was supposed to bring this, put it on your desk. I didn't think you were going to be here. And he said, that's okay. So as he turns to leave, he says, oh, can I ask you a quick question? And the executive says, sure. He says, you're here at the top. You know, how did you get to be at the top? And he says, well, it's simple. It's because I made good decisions. And he says, okay, good decisions. He starts to leave. He says, well, how do you make good decisions? He says, well, that's easy. It's through experience. And he says, okay. And he turns to leave, and he turns around and says, well, how do you get experience? And he says, through making bad decisions. So that's really the process. You know, you mess up, and you learn from it, and then you make better decisions, hopefully.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, the goal is to only make the bad decision once, though, because there's many bad decisions you're going to make.
I'll tell you, if you don't learn from that kind of stuff, then you're not going to go very far.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yep.
Well, Peggy,
I tell everybody that's worked. Well, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, that's what I tell everybody that's worked for me or my two boys, that, you know, you got to make decisions, and sometimes you're going to be good and sometimes you're going to be bad. The goal is that you try to make more good ones than bad ones and learn from the bad ones.
That's correct.
Yeah, everything is school. I mean, you never really graduate. Everything you do leads towards something else, and you have to draw from all those experiences. And that is experience. That's how you get to be an expert. You just have so much of a track record that it's undeniable.
That's right. Well, Peggy, how can our listeners get in touch with you?
You can hit my website. It's peggybrown.net, and you can see a lot of the work that I've done there and kind of understand a little bit more about what I do. That's kind of the best way, I think.
Okay, that sounds super. Well, thanks for being on our show today, Peggy. Our listeners really appreciate you sharing your experiences and insights, and there have been some really golden nuggets that they can learn from.
Well, thank you very much.
All right. Another great show, Bill.
It sure was, Ron. I also want to thank our sponsors today. A special thank to our sponsor, Pattens & Moore, your trusted guide through the innovation jungle. And Peggy, thanks so much for being on our show today. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. And you can listen again to this show as well as previous shows at our blog at thelaunchhour.businessradiox.com. This is Ron Reardon and Bill McHenry signing off another great session of The Launch Hour.